words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be always acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Well, Father Alex contacted me a couple of weeks ago and asked me if I would be able to preach on September 19th. And so I took a look at the calendar, and I saw that September 19th was International Speak Like a Pirate Day. And I said, that's awesome. I'm going to give the whole sermon in pirate talk. But that didn't go over very well. And then I noticed also, I was happy to take the opportunity because this is the, I think, unless something comes up, the last time I'll be preaching to you before I head back off to Africa. I'm heading back to Rwanda in the middle of October. I'll be teaching church history at Kigali Theological College in the capital of Rwanda, Kigali. And so it's a pretty intensive thing. I'll be teaching about 5 hours a day for 2.5 weeks to get everything in, but I don't really mind that. If you've been to East Africa, you know if you get an opportunity to do something, you take it. Because there's a lot of not doing anything. And so if you got a chance to do something, you go ahead and take the opportunity. So I'm looking forward to that, and in a way I'm looking forward to it. In another way, it's pretty difficult too, but that's how things work sometimes. I was happy to take that opportunity to get that encouragement from you before I head off. And then I looked at the lectionary for September 19th, and that's when I figured out why Father Alex wanted me to preach on the September 19th. The parable of the dishonest manager. Well, it's not a very popular sermon topic. It's a story about a dishonest manager or a steward. That's the way the King James Version translates it. I grew up on the King James Version. Every once in a while, I keep falling back into King James language. Okay, so I'll probably say steward a couple of times. The dishonest manager, the dishonest steward, the unjust steward. Yes, he is all those things, but he's also a risky manager. He's a prudent manager. He's a shrewd manager. He's a wise manager. In the parable, we've got a blend of risk-taking and wisdom. The manager is going to risk everything on two things. He's going to risk everything on the mercy of the master, and then on his own wisdom and his preparation and planning. But it is, a lot of people have found it a difficult parable to discuss. In fact, every commentary I looked at, the very first sentence was, this is the most difficult of all Jesus' parables to understand. And a few of them went on to discuss for the rest of the paragraph all the great figures of church history who've wrestled with the paragraph. Actually, I disagree with that. It's pretty clear what Jesus is saying. I don't think it's a very difficult parable to understand at all. It's just that we find it difficult to agree with what Jesus is saying. That's where the difficulty is. And there are two difficulties in addressing the parable. I want to address right off the bat. There are some difficulties here, okay? First of all, the first difficulty is that on a quick reading, it seems like Jesus is praising the dishonest servant for being dishonest. That he's praising the dishonesty of the servant. That's not at all the case. All right, we'll catch up to that part in just a minute, but that's not what's going on. He's not saying, you be dishonest like that guy was dishonest. That's not what he's getting at. The second difficulty, and here's some kind of structural things about the lectionary reading, the assigned reading for today, is that our lectionary really does us, I think, a disservice by where it divides up this chapter of Luke. Verses 9 through 13. The last part of the reading. Verses 9 through 13, that's a poem. It's written in Hebrew poetry, the parallel structure, the back and forth, the rhythm of ideas through there, almost like the Psalms, a lot like the Psalms. It's a separate section from that parable, first of all. Your clue there is at the start of verse 9, Jesus says, and I tell you. When Jesus says, and I tell you, that means I'm moving on to the next topic. And I tell you. If he says, but I tell you, that means he's explaining what came before. But now he's saying, and I tell you, he's moving on to the next topic. This is actually, verses 9 through 13, is actually a transition, a very, very brief transition, and then an introduction to the next parable. And it helps to see this parable in the chain of parables throughout the middle part of Luke. There's a set of five parables that has a build-up to a conclusion. Each of these parables tells a particular lesson. The first parable is a parable about a lost sheep. Jesus says, who among you, if he had 100 sheep and he lost one, would leave 99 out in the open country and go and look for the one until he'd found it? None of you are acting terribly surprised or shocked. A lot of what Jesus had to say has been said so much, and it's become so Christianized and so Christian-y, that it loses its original punch. Okay. And one theme in particular with sheep. Every time Jesus says something about sheep, he says something nutty about sheep. I was a shepherd for a summer. I know sheep. I'm not familiar with sheep. I don't want to be familiar with them. I know them. I know too much about them to be familiar with them. Okay. Everything he says about sheep is nutty. Okay. When Jesus says, "Who among you, having 100 sheep, would leave 99 roaming around in the countryside and go out to find the one?" The people listening to him said, "None of us." That's a pretty stupid thing to do. Leave 99 sheep wandering around out in the countryside and go look for one. No. What the shepherd does is say, "Well, I'll take that 1% loss for today. That's not bad. 1% today, that's not too bad." He's not going to leave 99 wandering around out in the countryside. But Jesus says, "Well, that's what the Father does when just one person comes into the kingdom of God. He'll go and look for that one person." And people said, "That's strange." If you don't believe me, take a look at when Jesus talks about sheep. At one point, maybe the most famous thing Jesus says about sheep is he says, "I'm the good shepherd. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep." You know what the people say in the very next sentence? They say, "You're crazy. You're nuts. You've lost your mind. You're insane. Because shepherds don't give their life for their sheep. The whole point of having sheep is that the sheep give their lives for the shepherd. The shepherd takes the sheep down to the market, sells the meat to the butcher, sells the wool to the cloth makers. The sheep give their lives for the shepherd. You don't believe me? Find it and look at it." People said, "You're nuts. You're crazy." And Jesus says, "Yeah, I'm the kind of crazy shepherd who goes looking for the one lost one. I'm the kind of crazy shepherd who gives my life for the sheep. You want to learn about the kind of sheep I'm talking about?" Jesus says, I'm talking about something different." Well, that's the first parable. Okay. The first parable, the lost sheep. Well, sheep really aren't worth all that much. Okay. 1 out of 100. All right. So the people listening hear that and they go, "That's kind of interesting." All right. So Jesus is talking about something that's lost. All right. The sheep, I mean, they're not worth all that much. The next parable is about a woman who loses a coin. Well, now, coins are valuable. So, and she rejoices. And so now the people say, okay, now Jesus is talking about something valuable that's lost. Okay, so it's something valuable. And then the next parable is the parable of the prodigal son, the topic of the sermon last week. Now we get it. What's lost is a person. There's a person who's lost. There's a person who's wandered away, treated the father poorly, wasted what the father has given him. Now he comes back hoping to find some kind of mercy, and he finds more mercy than he ever even hoped for. He finds forgiveness and acceptance and a welcoming. But there's not only the possibility of finding mercy, but finding an overwhelming mercy and forgiveness and acceptance. Now we come to this parable, the parable of the dishonest manager. And this builds on all we've said so far. Not only is something lost, something valuable that's lost, it's really me. Now we get to a point, and now, this parable, listen to this parable is, now it's a crisis. Now it's a critical point. Now you got to act. Now you got to move, and now you got to do something. Now's the time to act. You got to think fast and act fast. Because everything depends on what you do. There's a crucial and a critical need for mercy. This isn't just, someday I'll get back to the Father and everything will be okay and I'll be accepted. This parable is, you got to act now. And then we make the transition to the next parable, the parable of Lazarus and the rich man, which is about how you respond to God's mercy. The rich man is supposed to show mercy to Lazarus. But that's next Sunday, and I don't want to, if that gets selected, I don't want to start preaching next Sunday's sermon. And so this is in that part of the structure of Luke, okay, where Jesus is teaching us some things, and right now he's teaching us that we've got to act, that now is the time to act. You got to think smart, and you got to be smart, and you got to act smart. There's some questions to answer right at the start of the parable to help us get some things straight, and then we'll work our way down through the parable. The first issue is the question, is the master a good man? Is he an honorable man? Or is he a bad guy too? At the end of the story, are these two crooks patting each other on the back? Or what exactly is going on here? What's the character of the master? And I think that's an important thing to address. All the indications in the parable, everything points to the good character of the rich man, the master. See, I'm slipping it back into King James language. The King James translates that master, okay? The rich man or the master. Everything points to him being a good man. First of all, he doesn't respond with anger, even though he'd be pretty justified in responding with anger. He responds with wisdom in making a wise judgment. He's got to get rid of this guy who's ripping him off, okay? But he doesn't respond with anger. He doesn't scold or curse or anything like that. In fact, he shows mercy. We'll get to that in just a minute. But he doesn't show outrageous anger. Apparently, he has a good reputation in the community because somebody cares enough about him to tell him he's getting ripped off. If he was just a bad guy in town, nobody would really care whether he was getting ripped off or not. But somebody in the community respects him enough to say, hey, somebody's ripping you off. Your manager's ripping you off. So the manager is the good character in the story. The other major character, the manager, well, is he a good guy? Or is he honest or dishonest? Is maybe the manager here getting a bad rap? Is maybe he really doing the honest thing and just getting a bad rap from everybody who reads the parable? And there's two ways that this has been suggested, that the manager is actually doing something morally right, that the manager is actually honest in two ways. First of all, there's one approach which sees the manager as paying back what would have been the interest on the loan. Under Hebrew law, under rabbinical law, it was illegal to charge interest on a loan. You couldn't charge interest on a loan. You may be familiar with Sharia law in Islam, and Sharia finance is the same thing. You can't charge interest on a loan. Why would you want to lend somebody money and not get interest back? Well, here's how it works. Okay. Now remember, you can't charge interest. And so what you do is the person who wants the loan goes to the person with the money and says, I need to borrow $80. And the rich man says, $80? $80? You're such a good friend of mine. I'll loan you $100. But he only gives them $80. But he loaned them $100. You get it? That's not interest now. Mm-mm. The loan's for $100. It's just when the money changes hand, there's only four 20s. And I get five 20s back. But that's not interest. That's not interest. That's how Sharia finance works. And that's how rabbinical finance worked. But that isn't the case here. Okay, that's not the case here. Because the loan is in it's not a loan, it's rent on property. Okay, the payment that's being made are the products of the land. The rich man owns a lot of land. He subdivides his land, loans it out, and at the end of the harvest season, the renters bring in whatever they produced. Olive oil and wheat. We have the examples. So that's not the arrangement here. The other is that the manager here is taking back his cut. That he's got his finger in the pie, too, and he's giving back what he would have taken illegally and immorally from the renters. He's taking out his pocketing of his cut. But that can't fit here either. That can't fit here either. And then he's giving that back, you see. But that can't fit because these are incredibly high things he's giving back to the renters. 20%, 50%. The cash value of these two examples we're given works out to the same, I'm told. My sources tell me 500 denarii, which means about a year and a half's average salary. That's a lot, okay? We're talking about a lot of money. And if he was taking that immorally and under the table, well, this would have been a big scandal years before this thing happens. Now, there was always, the way that it worked in Hebrew society, when the managers are managing property, there's always a little bit of under the table money passing hands, okay? But that works something like this, okay? The renter comes to the agent, the manager, and says, today is the due date for the rent. I want to make sure the rich man gets my rent payment today. And the manager says, well, I'll do my best, but you know I've got so much going on today. I've got to keep things straight, and I don't know, I'm so distracted by everything I've got to do today. And the renter says, I got an idea. I'll give you a $10 bill, and you stick that $10 bill in your pocket. Then every time you put your hand in your pocket, you'll feel that $10 bill. And remember, you're supposed to take the payment to the rich guy. And the manager says, that's a great idea. That'll remind me, really, really. And takes that $10. I'll make sure I remember to get your payment in on time. There's always that kind of handling fee and that little underneath the table business, but nothing like this. Not 20% of the whole deal, 20%, 50% of the whole deal, a year and a half salary for every property. No, that doesn't make an awful lot of sense. No, the manager is dishonest. We could have just cut to the chase. Jesus says he's dishonest. I mean, who else do you want to believe? Jesus says he's dishonest, okay? There's no excusing the manager here. He's defrauded his master. He's defrauded the rich man, and there's no covering for him. Well, now we can address the parable itself and take a look at the parable itself. We have the rich man and his manager. He calls in his manager one day, and he says, the manager asks the master, the rich man, asks the manager, what is this that I hear about you? And what does the manager say? Nothing. Maybe you've been in this situation, okay? Is it true what I heard about you? And what's the wise response? Nothing, right? Not say anything. Okay, there's all kinds of stuff out there you might have heard about me. Right? I don't want to say, yeah, that's true. And then that would talk about something else. So he keeps quiet. And the rich man says, turn in your account book. Turn in the account of your management. You can no longer be manager. You're fired. And the manager has no response here either, not to the rich man. And in that silence, what the steward is saying, is he's saying, I'm guilty. He got me. I've got no defense because I did it. I can't make any excuses for it because it was wrong. And the master knows it. And the master has every right to fire me. He's got every right to punish me because he expects me to be responsible with his money, not to defraud him. I'm guilty. I got no defense. And the master knows it. He's got me. And he's got every right to punish me. But at the same time, the manager says, "The man, he let me off easy. He sure let me off easy. He showed me mercy." And a first century Jewish audience would pick up on this immediately, that the boss has let him off pretty easy. Because under rabbinical law, if he's defrauded, if the manager defrauds the master, the rich man, then, first of all, he has to pay back everything that he's defrauded. And if the manager wants to, he can haul him before the elders in town and have him put in prison. The master here is surprisingly merciful because the steward, the manager, could have been bankrupted. It's clear he doesn't have the money to slip back into the account. He's defrauded it and spent it. He could be bankrupted. He could be jailed. But he's not even scolded. All he does is lose his job. And for the first century, this is surprisingly merciful. Think about some of Jesus' other parables where dishonest workers are thrown in prison, beaten, cast out. And all this guy does is lose his job. He let me off easy. And the listeners would pick up on that. They say, man, he got off easy. He's lost his job. Now he's got to start thinking about what he's going to do next. He begins to consider the future. He's trained as a property manager. Problem is, he got fired for defrauding his master. Doesn't look too good on the resume. He says, what else am I going to do? I can't dig. I don't want to beg. He's got a big problem. He's got to think fast. He's got to think fast. He's got to come up with a plan. And it's a plan that's going to involve a lot of risk. Because if this plan fails, he's going to prison for sure. If the plan fails, he's going to prison. He's lost everything. But if he succeeds, he'll be a big hero. It's a risky plan, but it's a pretty slick plan. He calls in the debtors, the renters. And he does this quickly. All through the middle part of that parable is quick. Got to do this quick. Because the manager has no legal authority to represent the master anymore. He's lost that when he was fired. You can no longer be manager. He's lost any kind of legal authority. Anything from here on out, the courts won't recognize. The law doesn't recognize. He's got to move fast because the renters don't know this yet. They haven't heard that he's been fired. Because if they knew that he'd been fired, and they colluded with him in the scheme he's cooking up, well, they'd get in a lot of trouble. They'd make the rich man mad. They'd make the master, the landowner, mad, angry. He wouldn't rent to them again. They'd lose access to the property that maybe they've been farming for years. Maybe they've made improvements to. These are such large sums that we're talking about that the size of property that these rich men are renting must be an incredible size. Must be an incredible piece of land. They'd lose access to a plot of land that size for their own farming operations. These are wealthy men. Okay, they're paying a year and a half's annual average salary to rent the land. This is a big operation. Those numbers that we have the two examples of, 1,000 gallons of olive oil. That's a lot of olive oil. We've got a little bottle of olive oil at home, and we've had it for years. I haven't used it up yet. 1,000 gallons of olive oil, 1,100 bushels of wheat. This is a big operation. And the renters, well, they know they're in a culture that values loyalty and trust. They don't want to break that relationship with the landowner. If they had known about this, they wouldn't have gone along with the scheme. So the manager has to move fast. He's got to get them in, get this taken care of before they find out, because they also won't go along with it. So he calls in the renters. And implicit in the story here, there's no other way to read the story, what the manager does is he calls them in and he says something like this. He convinces the renters that he's intervened on their behalf and the master has cut their rent for this year. And he calls them in and he says, well, you know, times are tough this year and we haven't gotten a lot of rain this year. So I went to the master and I said, look, can we cut back on the rent this year? Your renters, they're really hurting. And he didn't want to go along with it at first, but eventually I talked him into it. I talked him into it. And so you can cut your rent for this year. Quickly. Take this and write this quickly before he changes his mind. He might change his mind. Now, the debtor, he does this quickly. The debtors can't have any suspicion that this is something the master doesn't want to happen. Or, like I said, they wouldn't go along with it. And they sign the new figures in the book. The manager, you see, keeps the account book. He keeps that record of who owns what. And he opens it up, and each renter individually comes in. And he tells them to handwrite the new number in the accounts. That's how it works, so that that's in their own handwriting, that would see that they agreed to that amount. And then the steward, you see, can't go in and change the amount on them. For 100, write 50. For 100 measures of wheat, write 80. He calls in all the renters, slashes their rent. And then he does what the master told him to, and that is to turn in his account book. He takes the account book into the master, the owner, the landowner. He hands over the account book, and he closes his eyes. And the rich man, the master, takes the account book, and he leafs through it, and he notices all the changes that have been made today. And the master closes his eyes. And the master knows what's going on all over the village. All over the village. A bunch of husbands have just gotten home and told their wives, break out the fatted calf. We're having the best wine for dinner tonight. We saved a whole bunch of money on the rent for this year. A year and a half's worth of average salary that we've been saved. You know why? Because the master's the best guy in town. The landowner, the rich guy, he's the best guy in town. Now, he's the second best guy in town. The best guy in town is the manager. The manager went to him and got him to cut our rent. Those are the two best guys in town. And the manager has, the master, the rich landowner, has two choices. He can take back the gift. He can go to the renters and say, wait, he wasn't authorized to do that. I'd fired him earlier in the morning. He had no authority to make those changes. You got to give that back. Now, the renters would have gone along with it, okay, but they would despise him now. And he thinks about those people saying all those good things about him. Now, he's the big man in town. Or his other choice, and his other choice, is just to keep quiet about the whole thing. Go ahead and pay the cost, pay the price of losing out on all that rent money. Just keep quiet about it. And the master opens his eyes and looks at the manager and says, "That was pretty slick. That was pretty slick. You got me. I'll eat it. I'll take the cost." Does the manager keep his job? Probably not. I doubt it. But he's not thrown in prison. He's not beaten. He's not bankrupted. And the landowner, keeps quiet about that defrauding thing because that would mess up, muddy the waters a little bit. And the manager can go off, find another job, maybe with a good recommendation. Now, what is Jesus doing here? Well, first of all, he's certainly not praising the manager for being dishonest. Okay, that's not at all what's going on here. What Jesus is doing here is what he often does, which is that he points out actions of people that are praiseworthy when the people themselves aren't worthy of their praise. Jesus does this a number of different times in different parables. Jesus has one parable about an unjust judge, a judge who refuses to issue a ruling in a case. Apparently he's received a bribe not to issue a ruling. But there's a woman who wants justice, and she keeps going to the judge every time she sees him, begging him for justice. Until finally the judge says, "Okay, just stop, you're driving me nuts, just stop bugging me about it, okay, I'll issue a decision in your favor." The point of the parable is not that if you become a judge, then you should be unjust. Okay, that's not the point of the parable. The point of the parable is that even if an unjust judge gives in to a woman and gives her what she wants, what she needs, how much more will God give you what you need? If that crooked judge will give you what you need, how much more will God give you what you need? He has another parable, Jesus does, about a neighbor who, the two neighbors, and a visitor comes in late at night to the first neighbor's house. He has no food. And so he goes over to the second neighbor's house. And he says, "I've got a visitor from out of town, and I don't have any food to give him. You need to let me borrow some food so I can feed my friend, my visitor." And the second neighbor makes all kinds of excuses about why he won't come down and loan some food out. Not only is that neighbor being a real jerk, not only is he being unhelpful to his neighbor, he's making the whole village look bad. Because now when that visitor leaves and goes to the next village, he's going to say, "Those people in that village back there, they don't feed you anything. There are a bunch of low people back there." He's making the whole village look bad. Until finally the neighbor says, all right, stop banging on my door. I'll give you some food." The point here isn't if someone asks you for food, make them bang on the door a whole bunch of times. Okay, that's not what's being praised here. The point is that if a jerky neighbor will loan you food if you bug him long enough, how much more will God just be anxious to provide blessing? Jesus has another parable about a man who goes out, he's walking across a field, and he sees something kind of funny, he digs it up, it's buried treasure. So he covers it back up really fast, and he goes to the guy who owns the land and says, "I think I might like to buy that piece of property." And he buys that piece of property, and the first thing he does, he goes out and digs up that buried treasure. Jesus is not giving us here a lecture on real estate investment. Okay, the point isn't the morality of what this guy's done. The point of the parable is there's something so special, the kingdom of God, that once you catch a glimpse of what it is, you've got to do whatever it takes to get it. You've got to get it. If an unjust judge can make the right decision, why can't God? If that jerk of a neighbor finally gives you what you need, how much more will God give you what you need? If that sneaky guy can find buried treasure, what kind of treasure can you find? And if this dishonest manager discovers he can rely on his master's mercy, how much more will God help you when you rely on God's mercy? The landowner in the story, there's two sides to his character. He's a man of judgment. You're fired. He's got every right to bring that judgment. But he's also a man of mercy. At the start of the story, the manager learns that this rich man is a man of mercy. He's not thrown in prison. He doesn't have to repay the money. God, you see, is a God of judgment. But he's also a God of mercy. And the manager in the story here is in a big crisis because judgment is coming. By the end of the day, everybody in town is going to know he's been fired. They're going to know why he's been fired. He'll be out of a job. He'll never be able to work in his profession again. He's going to lose everything. He knows that judgment is coming. He also knows he's got no excuse for it. He's got no defense because he's guilty. And the master knows it. And the master has every right to bring judgment and to bring punishment. The manager learns that he's got to rely on the mercy of the master. That the master who showed a little bit of mercy at the start of the story is still going to be merciful at the end of the story. Or else he loses everything. He is forced to rely on the mercy of the master. That master is going to pay the cost of all that wrongdoing. All that sneaky, underhanded trickery, the master is going to cover the cost. And at the end of the parable, that manager's risk is vindicated. That trust is vindicated. That master, that rich man, that landowner, who at the start of the story had shown a little bit of mercy, ends up showing an extreme amount of mercy. And Jesus closes up this parable with talking about two groups of people. And I'm not sure that they're exclusive groups of people. I'm not sure about that. First of all, he talks about the children of this world, or the King James Version, the children of this age. Jesus says the children of this world. They take their situation in life seriously. When they see danger, they face danger quickly. And they plan wisely for the future. And in a sense, all of us are children of the world. We live in the world. We pride ourselves on the wisdom that we take in business arrangements. We take our situation in life seriously. When we face danger, we learn to deal with it quickly. Hopefully, we plan wisely for the future. And when we do all those things, we feel good about ourselves. Because that's what we're supposed to do. You're supposed to plan wisely. You're supposed to take your life seriously. You're supposed to face danger quickly. But Jesus goes on to say, the children of light, and I would hope that would be all of us, those of us who want God's light in our life, the children of light, aren't as wise. We don't take steps to avoid judgment. We don't take our situation seriously. We don't take our spiritual situation seriously. We don't face spiritual danger quickly. We don't plan wisely for our spiritual future. We may take our business lives, our economic lives, our financial lives very seriously. But we aren't so serious about our spiritual life. We haven't quite realized that our chief concern is one's status with God. That we stand in a situation where we face judgment. And we've got no excuse, no defense, because we did it. Because all of us are sinners. And we come to a place where we're forced to rely on the mercy of the Master, on the mercy of God. God who's shown us even a little bit of mercy in our life. We're forced to rely on that He'll continue to be merciful to us. We had to rely on the mercy of the Master who pays the cost for all that wrongdoing. The Master who covers the cost, who pays the price. As Paul says in the Timothy reading, Christ Jesus who gave Himself a ransom for all. Who makes a payment for all. We're forced to rely on the mercy of that Master. And at the end we discover that that mercy is well placed and that trust is vindicated. The chief concern is our status with God. Do we stand under judgment or do we stand under mercy? The only hope is to rely on God's mercy. To rely on the one who paid that cost, who paid that price. To accept what Jesus did on the cross as the payment for all the wrongdoing that I've done. To admit that I'm in a crisis, that I'm under God's judgment. I've got no excuse and I've got no defense. All I can trust is the mercy of the Master. In Jesus' name, amen.